Jina Margrita Gjus, nsemmilkom u nilqakom għal programm ieħor fis-serje l-ħrejjef, l-erf u l-maġija. U llum se nitkellmu dwar Charles Perrault, kittieb ieħor Franċiż, u se nirrakkontalkom ħrafa li ġiet ispirata minn serial killer. Iva, hija xejn makabra. Però hemm ħrafa oħra li se nirrakkontalkom illum ukoll li l-feministi żgur mhumiex jieħdu gost biha. Issa fl-aħħar programm aħna tkellimna dwar dawk il-kittieba Franċiżi nisa. Tiftakru naħseb tas-seklu 17 li bdew jirrakkontaw il-ħrejf tagħhom għall-adulti fis-salotti tagħhom imbagħad kitbuhom u publikawhom. Charles Perrault kien wieħed mill-kittieba li kien iżur is-salotti tagħhom. U min jaf kem ġabar ideat min għandawn il-nisa. Sar avukat pal-missiru u minħabba li kien kittib ġibet l-attenzjoni tal-ministru Colbert u sar il-segretarju tijaw. Daħajru biex jinaqat ma l-Akademi Francez. L-Akademia damet ħafna maċċettatu pala membru għax kien maħsub li kienet jintuża mill-kollaboraturi tar-re Luigi 14 biex jispija fuq il-membri tagħha. Fil-fatt, kien sar mitla sew tar-re, meta kiteb Le siècle de Louis le Grand fl-1687 The Age of Louis the Great fej kien ifaħħar ir-renju tar-re Luigi 14 u mar jaqra dan ix-xogħol ġo l-Akademi Franċiż ma ntlaqa xejn tajjeb. Fil-fatt però ingħaqad ma l-Akademi Franċiż fl-1671 u kien hu li beda t-taqbida bejn is-sistema letterarja antika u dik moderna, kerel, des anciens e de modern. Bla dubju, u kien mal-moderni, u biex juri kemm il-letteratura moderna kienet superjuri, fl-1687, kif semmejna diġa, kiteb Le siècle de Louis le Grand. U bejn l-1688 u l-1692 kiteb parallel des anciens e de modern. Il-paralleli bell-antiku l-modern. Però kien iħoss li l-letteratura Franċiża tant kienet superjuri, li wkoll Omeru kien jammetti li kieku kien għadu ħaj. Fl-1686 intefa bruħu bġismu fuq il-poezija epika reliġjuża. Iżda fl-aħħar 8 snin ta' ħajtu fl-1695, meta tilef xogħlu bħala segretarju minħabba li l-Ministru Colbert kien warrab u wara ftit miet, iddedika lilu nifsu għat-tfal tiegħu u beda jikteb il-ħrejjef. Ippubblika Tales and Stories of the Past with Morals, Istwar u Kont du Tomp Passe, magħrufin aktar bħala The Tales of Mother Goose, Le Kont de Ma Merloj, fejn insibu uħut mill-aqwa ħrejjef pal Cinderella, Little Red Riding Hood, Sleeping Beauty u Puss in Boots. Tales and Stories of the Past with Morals, Istwar u Kont du Tomp Passe, ġi publikat blisem tat-tifel tiegħu Pierre. Forsi għax kien jibżam il-kritika tal-kittieba, li kienu jsostnu li l-letteratura antika kienet superjuri. Waħda mill-ħrejjef ta' Charles Perrault, meħuda mill-Istwar u Kont du Tomp Passe, hija magħrufa bħala La Barbe Bleu, Bluebeard. L-istorja qiegħda dwar wieħed nobli violenti li kellu l-vizzju li joqtol in-nisa tiegħu. Ħafna pajjiżi għandhom il-verżjoni tagħhom ta' dan il-karattru ukoll id-daqna tiegħu. Fil-li ħamra, fil-li ħadra, fil-li bjonda, imma r-raġel dejjem jibqa' kattiv. L-Italja Bluebeard huwa xitan li qabbad in-nisa jaħsulu l-ħwejjeġ. Fil-Ġermanja huwa saħħar li qatta la rajjes tiegħu biċċiet u fin-Norveġja huwa troll li jikser onq kull mara li tirrifjutah. Perikolużi eh, dan l-irġiel. Il-verżjoni Franċiża ta' Charles Perrault hija x'aktar xi bbażata fuq is-serial killer aristokratiku tal-15-il seklu, il-kavalier Gilles de Rais. Dak kien iġġieled flimkien ma' Giovanna d'Arco. U kellu post prominenti fl-armata, minn flok nisa, dak kien joqtol tfal. Huwa maħsub li qatel bejn 80 u 200 tifel u tifla. Mhux tab xejn speċjal malla, U Bluebeard, pal dan il-kavallir, kienu kol senjur. Din il-ħrafa setet ukoll ġiet imnebħa mir-re ta' Bretanja, ir-re Kun Mar, li qata' ras il-mara tiegħu Trifin li kienet ila. Iżda l-kemm il-ħrafa ta' Però seta' ġiet ibbażata fuq il-veru, tibqa' storja fantastika, għattil li werwer pal ġganti u sħaħar. Il-mara f'din il-ħrafa tkun lesta li tafda l-futur tagħha f'idejn bniedem li kien jidher stram għax kellu barba blu. Iżda għall-flus kienet lesta li tagħmel kollox biex imbagħad il-kurzita tagħha iġġala ssir taf dak li f'miljun sena qatt ma stenniet. Naħseb xieraq li issa nisimgħuha din il-ħrafa. Bluebeard ta' Charles Perrault. There was once a man who had fine houses, both in town and country, a deal of silver and gold plate, embroidered furniture, and coaches gilded all over with gold. But this man was so unlucky as to have a blue beard, which made him so frightfully ugly that all the women and girls ran away from him. One of his neighbours, a lady of quality, had two daughters who were perfect beauties. He desired of her one of them in marriage, leaving to her choice which of the two she would bestow on him. Neither of them would have him, and they sent him backwards and forwards from one to the other, not being able to bear the thoughts of marrying a man who had a blue beard. Adding to their disgust and aversion was the fact that he already had been married to several wives, and nobody knew what had become of them. Bluebeard, to engage their affection, took them with their mother and three or four ladies of their acquaintance, with other young people of the neighbourhood, to one of his country houses, where they stayed a whole week. The time was filled with parties, hunting, fishing, dancing, mirth and feasting. Nobody went to bed, but all passed the night in rallying and joking with each other. In short, everything succeeded so well that the youngest daughter began to think that the man's beard was not so very blue after all, and that he was a mighty civil gentleman. As soon as they returned home, the marriage was concluded. About a month afterwards, Bluebeard told his wife that he was obliged to take a country journey for 6 weeks at least, about affairs of very great consequence. He desired her to divert herself in his absence, to send for her friends and acquaintances, to take them into the country, if she pleased, and to make a good cheer wherever she was. "Here," said he, "are the keys to the great wardrobes, wherein I have my best furniture. These are to my silver and gold plate, which is not every day in use. These open my strong boxes, which hold my money, both gold and silver. These my caskets of jewels, and this is the master key to all my apartments. But as for this little one here, it is the key to the closet at the end of the great hall on the ground floor. Open them all, go into each and every one of them, except that little closet which I forbid you, and forbid it in such a manner that if you happen to open it, you may expect my just anger and resentment." She promised to observe very exactly whatever he had ordered. Then he, after having embraced her, got into his coach and proceeded on his journey. Her neighbours and good friends did not wait to be sent for by the newly married lady. They were impatient to see all the rich furniture of her house, and had not dared to come while her husband was there because of his blue beard, which frightened them. They ran through all the rooms, closets and wardrobes, which were all so fine and rich that they seemed to surpass one another. After that, they went up into the two great rooms, which contained the best and richest furniture. They could not sufficiently admire the number and beauty of the tapestry, beds and couches, cabinets, stands, tables and looking-glasses, in which you might see yourself from head to foot. Some of them were framed with glass, others with silver, plain and gilded, the finest and most magnificent that they had ever seen. They ceased not to extol and envy the happiness of their friend, who in the meantime in no way diverted herself in looking upon all these rich things, because of the impatience, she had to go and open the closet on the ground floor. She was so much pressed by her curiosity that without considering that it was very uncivil for her to leave her company, she went down a little back staircase and with such excessive haste that she nearly fell and broke her neck. Having come to the closet door, she made a stop for some time, thinking about her husband's orders and considering what unhappiness might attend her if she was disobedient. But the temptation was so strong that she could not overcome it. She then took the little key and opened it, trembling. At first, she could not see anything plainly, because the windows were shut. After some moments, she began to perceive that the floor was all covered over with clotted blood, on which lay the bodies of several dead women, ranged against the walls. These were all the wives whom Bluebeard had married and murdered, one after another. She thought she should have died for fear, and the key which she pulled out of the lock fell out of her hand. After having somewhat recovered her surprise, she picked up the key, locked the door, and went upstairs into her chamber to recover. But she could not. So much was she frightened. Having observed that the key to the closet was stained with blood, she tried two or three times to wipe it off. But the blood would not come out. In vain did she wash it, and even rub it with soap and sand. The blood still remained, for the key was magical, and she could never make it quite clean. When the blood was gone off one side, it came again on the other. Bluebeard returned from his journey the same evening, saying that he had received letters upon the road informing him that the affair he went about had concluded to his advantage. His wife did all she could to convince him that she was extremely happy about his speedy return. The next morning he asked her for the keys, which she gave him, but with such a trembling hand that he easily guessed what had happened.
"What? Is not the key of my closet among the rest?"
"I must have left it upstairs upon the table."
"Fail not to bring it to me at once."
After several going backwards and forwards, she was forced to bring him the key. Bluebeard, having very attentively considered it, said to his wife,
"Why is there blood on the key?"
"I do not know," cried the poor woman, paler than death.
"You do not know? I very well know. You went into the closet, did you not? Very well, madam, you shall go back and take your place among the ladies you saw there."
Upon this, she threw herself at her husband's feet and begged his pardon with all the signs of a true repentance, vowing that she would never more be disobedient. She would have melted a rock, so beautiful and sorrowful was she. But Bluebeard had a heart harder than any rock.
"You must die, madam, at once."
"Since I must die," she said, looking upon him with her eyes all bathed in tears, "give me some time, little time, to say my prayers."
"I give you half a quarter of an hour, but not one moment more."
When she was alone, she called out to her sister and said to her, "Sister Anne," for that was her name, "go up, I beg you, to the top of the tower and look if my brothers are not coming. They promised me that they would come today, and if you see them, give them a sign to make haste." Her sister Anne went up to the top of the tower, and the poor afflicted woman cried out from time to time, "Anne, Sister Anne, do you see anyone coming?" And Sister Anne said, "I see nothing but a cloud of dust in the sun and the green grass." In the meanwhile, Bluebeard, holding a great sabre in his hand, cried out as loud as he could bawl to his wife,
"Come down instantly, or I shall come up to you!"
"One moment longer, if you please."
And then she cried out very softly, "Anne, Sister Anne, do you see anybody coming?" And Sister Anne answered,
I see nothing but a cloud of dust in the sun and the green grass.
Come down quickly, or I will come up to you.
I am coming,
answered his wife. And then she cried, Anne, Sister Anne, do you not see anyone coming?
I see, replied Sister Anne, a great cloud of dust approaching us.
Are they my brothers?
Alas, no, my dear sister, I see a flock of sheep.
Will you not come down?
One moment longer,
said his wife. And then she cried out, Anne, Sister Anne, do you see nobody coming?
I see, said she,
two horsemen, but they are still a great way off.
God be praised, replied the poor wife joyfully. They are my brothers. I will make them a sign, as well as I can, for them to make haste.
Then Bluebeard bawled out so loud that he made the whole house tremble. The distressed wife came down and threw herself at his feet, all in tears, with her hair about her shoulders.
This means nothing, you must die.
Then taking hold of her hair with one hand and lifting up the sword with the other, he prepared to strike off her head. The poor lady, turning about to him and looking at him with dying eyes, desired him to afford her one little moment to recollect herself.
No, no, commend yourself to God,
and was just ready to strike. At this very instant, there was such a loud knocking at the gate that Bluebeard made a sudden stop. The gate was opened, and the two horsemen entered. Drawing their swords, they ran directly to Bluebeard. He knew them to be his wife's brothers, one a dragoon, the other a musketeer, so that he ran away immediately to save himself. But the two brothers pursued and overtook him before he could get to the steps of the porch. Then they ran their swords through his body and left him dead. The poor wife was almost as dead as her husband and had not the strength enough to rise and welcome her brothers. Bluebeard had no heirs, and so his wife became mistress of all his estate. She made use of one part of it to marry her sister Anne to a young gentleman who had loved her a long while, another part to buy captain's commissions for her brothers, and the rest to marry herself to a very worthy gentleman who made her forget the ill time she had passed with Bluebeard. First moral. Curiosity, in spite of its appeal, often leads to deep regret. To the displeasure of many a maiden, its enjoyment is short-lived. Once satisfied, it ceases to exist and always costs dearly. Another moral. Apply logic to this grim story, and you will ascertain that it took place many years ago. No husband of our age would be so terrible as to demand the impossible of his wife, or would he be such a jealous malcontent? For whatever the colour of her husband's beard, the wife of today will let him know who the master is. Charles Perrault għandu koll rafa ferm kurjuża b'isem ta' Griseld li titratta dwar li l-mara fi żwieġ kellha tobdi r-raġel tagħha akkosta kollox ukoll jekk kun qiegħda taċċetta li tissagrifika l-ħajja ta' wlieda. Fil-fatt kif diġà rajna fi Bluebeard, in-nisa fil-kitba ta' Perrault huma rappreżentati bħala vittmi, dajfa, passivi u li ma kienux jafu jiddifendu lilhom infushom. Dan jikkuntrasta ferm għall-mod kif rajnihom jiġu deskritti minn Dolnoy, Villeneuve u Beaumont mill-kittieba nisa ta' dak iż-żmien. Il-ħrafa ta' Griseld kienet waħda minn mit storja li Giovanni Boccaccio ġabar fix-xogħol letterarju De Cameron li reġa kiteb bejn l-1370 u l-1371. Issa l-istorja qiegħda hekk li grupp ta' 10 nisa wirġiel minn Firenze jinġabru ġo din il-villa Toskana fil-Kampanja u dan jirrakkontaw storja kull wieħed għal 10 tiem. B'hekk fil-fatt hemm mit storja. Fil-waqt li l-pesta bubonika kienet qiegħda tħalli ħafna vitmi. Għalhekk huwa maħsub li Griseld hija allegorija medjevali fejn ir-raġel il-Markis ta' Soluzzo huwa Alla u Griseld qed tirrappreżenta il-vitmi. Il-poeta Francesco Petrarca Tant intlaqat minn din l-istorja li immemorizza u traduċija bil-Latin. Minħabba li Petrarka kien ħafna iktar magħruf minn Boccaccio, f'daqqa waħda din l-istorja saret magħrufa, tant li uża Chaucer u kif qed naraw tliet sekli wara Charles Perrault. U dan ta' il-verżjoni tiegħu b'dak l-element maġiku fejn isostni li rien u mond ne plu trompe ke l-apparence, li xejn fid-dinja mhu aktar arriqi mill-apparenza. Mela ċiex nisimawa Griselda ta' Charles Perrault. At the foot of the mountains where the paw escapes from his bed of reeds to the neighbouring plain, there once lived a youthful and gallant prince, the favourite of the whole countryside. Combining in himself all the gifts of body and spirit, he was strong, clever, skilful in war, and displayed great enthusiasm for the arts. This splendid disposition was obscured, however, by a sombre cloud, a melancholy mood, which caused the prince to feel in the depths of his heart that all women were faithless and deceivers. His subjects, nevertheless, kept urging him to provide them with an heir to the throne, someone who would rule them with the same affection that the prince had always shown. In reply to their urgings, the prince said, "This zeal with which you urge me to marry pleases me greatly. I am deeply touched, but I am convinced that happiness can be found in a marriage only when one of the two partners is dominant over the other." By chance, or perhaps by destiny, the prince turned one day into a winding road where none of the huntsmen followed him, and his eyes were suddenly confronted by a most delightful object, the sweetest and kindliest ever seen under heaven. It was a young shepherdess. She would indeed have tamed the most savage. The moment she saw him, she blushed deeply, and this in turn added to her beauty. Under this innocent veil of modesty, the prince discovered a simplicity, a sweetness, and a sincerity which he did not believe possible in any woman. He drew nearer to her, and even more timid and confused than she, he explained in a trembling voice that he had lost all trace of the other huntsman, and asked her if perchance the chase had passed through that part of the wood. "No one has been seen in this solitary place except you. But do not be disturbed. I will put you on the right road again." There he found her living with her father, and learned that her name was Griselda. Together the girl and the old man lived simply on the milk of their flock, and wove their garments from the fleece. As the days went by, the more he saw of her, the brighter the prince's love burned for the shepherdess. He was filled with an extreme happiness, and finally one day he called his counsellors together and spoke to them. "In accordance with your wishes, I am at last planning to wed, although I shall not take a wife from a strange land, but from someone among us, someone lovely, wise, and well-bred. I shall eagerly await the great moment to inform you of my choice." And little did they know that he had fallen in love with a shepherdess. And they got married. Before a year had passed, their marriage was blessed with a child, not a prince, as might have been desired, but a little princess so lovely and endearing that every moment her father kept coming back to gaze on her again. Her mother, still more enraptured, never took her eyes off her. In time, the love of the prince became a little less ardent than formerly, so that his evil mood seemed to grow again. As a result of the melancholy with which his mind had been tainted, he followed her about, watching her. He seemed to enjoy limiting her pleasures and alarming her, mixing the false with the true. And so she was confined to the palace and retired to her rooms as he had ordered her, far from the pleasures of the court. Convinced that one's wardrobe and its accessories are the dearest delight of a woman, the prince rudely demanded her pearls, rubies, rings and jewels, all of which he had given her as a token of his affection when he became her husband. "I will see what lies behind this false goodness of hers, and makes all my efforts useless. My blows have been directed only where there is no longer any love. But for her infant child, for the little princess, she has shown the greatest tenderness. If I am to succeed in my testing her, it is there that I must direct my efforts." At that moment she was about to nurse the baby who was lying against her heart, smiling. "I see that you love her," said the prince. "It will be necessary, however, that while she is still very young, I separate her from you, so that she will be brought up with the right manners, and will be protected from the bad habits into which she will surely fall if she remains with you." By the best of good luck, I have found a lady who will bring her up with all the virtues and good manners which a princess should have. You will arrange then to part with her. They will be coming soon to take her away." At these words he left her, not having the courage to watch them snatch from her arms this pledge of their love. A thousand tears bathed her face as she watched in mournful dejection the darkest moment of her unhappiness. As soon as those who were to carry out this cruel and sad undertaking appeared, she told them, "I must obey." Then taking up her child, she gazed on her, and kissing her with a mother's love, weeping, she gave her up. Alas, how bitter was her sorrow! To tear an infant from its mother's heart, this is grief itself. Not far from the city was a convent, famous for its antiquity, where the nuns lived according to strict rules, under the eyes of an abbess, renowned for her piety. It was here, in silence, and without revealing the secret of her birth, that they took the infant. Dispjaċini li jemmek smajtu bis-siltiet żgħar minnha din il-ħrafa, però intkom tkun tistgħu tkomplu taqrawha wieħidkom. Imma li se ngħidilkom huwa illi bħal kull ħrafa għandha l-happy ending tagħha u ma jonqos li meta l-prinċep jara li l-mara tiegħu kienet lesta li tissagrifika kollox u koll li titnezza mir-rikezzi u terġa' l-ħajja f'qira ta' meta kienet xebba, u koll li żewġa jiżewweġ mar oħra fl-aħħar jippremja billi jurija li din il-mara li kien se jiżewweġ ma kienet ħadd ħlief bintom. U l-paċi tirrenja f'dik il-familja. Jiena nerġa' nkun magħkom għall-programm li jmiss fejn se nitkellmu dwar l-aħwa Grimm u ħrafa li ftit li xejn nafu Ħans tal-Ħadid. Grazzi tal-li oġobkom terġgħu tkunu miegħi, jiena Margita Juice insellmilkom.